Hey!
How are you?
This is another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer. I'm Joe Patrice.
Hey, Joe Patrice.
That was Catherine Rubino. We're editors here at Above the Law, and we meet every week to give you a, you know, we have a little conversation about
the tete-a-tete.
Yeah, big stories of the week that was in legal. But of course, we begin, as always, with a little bit of humanizing.
Small talk.
Let's have some small talk. So, hey.
Yeah, how have you been?
Good. I took some time to go see the total eclipse. So
of the heart or
no?
Oh,
of the actual one. Yeah. Though I did listen. We did listen to that song on the way to the.
I would have been disappointed had you not.
In fairness, we didn't listen to the original version. We listened to the version by the Dan Band,
which is actually a fantastic version.
The superior
version.
Be honest. Yeah. So yeah. So I went to do that. I saw a total eclipse a few years ago. Actually, you were along on that trip. You were not along on this trip. Saw it a few years ago. And I think you and seven
at this point. It's not
sure. You know. Sure. I think you would agree with me that as a phenomenon, it's impossible to describe, really.
I think my takeaway, having witnessed the one 7 years ago in person, was, oh, this is why you believe in... in you know, a God in the sky and all this kind of stuff. This is why you believe in all the things, because it seems otherworldly, like there are powers beyond you. It is truly a cosmic event.
It's one of those things that's really impossible to capture on film. Like, yeah. I'd seen pictures of eclipses before, and I remember the first one I went to, I was like, oh, well, I'm sure it'll be whatever. And it just isn't. It's like you can't really describe the kind of awesome feeling of it as it happens. And so did it again. This time it was here in New York State, though a long way from where I am. But I took a trip up toward the Canadian border and got a chance to see it. And it was nice.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I made a trip since we've last spoke, but it was not nearly as good. I went down to West Virginia to visit some friends, and my daughter had diarrhea the entire time. Yeah, so I became very, very familiar with the bathrooms along the route. And I mean, I think it was like an overnight trip, and we went through, I think, 8 different outfits. So not just because she's a fashionista like me, but because there was poop on all of it.
Yeah. And now all of our listeners have to know about that too.
I mean, everybody poops, Joe.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That is that book. That was an early Family Guy joke, which, God, how long's Family Guy been on the air at this point?
Is it still on the air?
Oh yeah. I think
is
it's
it?
Like 20 years. Yeah.
No, Family Guy is not still on the air.
Yeah, I think so.
Is it? I don't know. I have not watched it in like 10.
Yeah, 22 seasons.
And counting?
Yeah.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, no. anyway, there was a joke about that book in the early seasons of that. Anyway, so yeah, no, that's cool.
No, it was not cool. But it was something I survived.
Oh, well, there's that. I had something to say. I can't even
about
remember.
Poop?
No.
I didn't realize this was going to make you so uncomfortable. I feel like I need to make more poop jokes.
Well, I mean, okay.
It's not even a joke. I mean, it's just like the reality
of
an infant.
Yeah, so fair enough. I had some other thing. Oh, I was going to talk about loyal listeners, watchers might have seen me on CNN last week.
Oh, that's right. I did happen to catch you on the Abby Phillip show.
I did tell you I was doing it. So, yeah.
Well, I also follow your Twitter account.
Fair enough.
And you did mention it on X.
That's a good point. Yeah. If you follow me on the various social medias, you would have had a heads up that it was coming. Yeah. Just to talk about some of these legal cases. I haven't done TV in so many years. I had gotten into a routine as being the kind of regular Supreme Court news person that they would bring on Al Jazeera America to talk about new Supreme Court cases. And then Al Jazeera America went out of business like about a month and a half after I started being that guy. So I haven't really done much since. So yeah, it was
nice
to get to flex that muscle again.
Well, that's a good time.
Yeah. So maybe stay tuned. Maybe there'll be more of those. We'll see. Anything else? That's good?
That's all I got. Lots of poop. I do love how uncomfortable it makes you.
I'm trying to class
up the joint.
I'm classing up the joint.
Yeah, here. I knew you were going to say that. You're wildly predictable.
You know what is also full of a bunch of poop? The U.S. News and World Report rankings of law schools came out this week, and we got insights into where they think law schools are ranked. And what do you think?
It's been a rough couple years for U.S. News rankings. I am not particularly impressed by the rankings this year or last year, since they've sort of had to rejigger their formula. If you'll recall, I think it was the end of 2022 when Yale pulled out of the rankings, which led a cascade of other law schools pulling out. I think it's about 25% now that don't provide information to U.S. News, and there's another small percentage that only provides information that's otherwise publicly available. So they don't do anything special for U.S. News. And the results are not inspiring, I don't think. There's some movement, I guess, in this year's rankings, but, you know, they have Duke tied with Harvard Law at number 4. And if there's anything I think of when I think of Harvard Law School, 4th is not it.
So let's go through. So they're in a tie, I believe, with Penn and Virginia. All of them are tied. Let's go through things that Duke is better than or tied with Harvard at. No, it's not too tied. Let's think of things that Duke should be considered better than Harvard at.
I got one.
Okay.
Basketball.
Okay. So this ends the list.
That's not fair. Duke's football team is pretty okay.
I guess that's fair. sure. I mean, compared to
Harvard. That's what we are literally comparing it to.
Yeah, I've heard that their football team can actually win women's basketball games, too. Did you?
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
You were telling me about this.
Yeah, I've never seen a piece of social media that was meant to promote a team that has made me hate the team more. But the Duke football TikTok account had a thing where, you know, when they go and they interview players about the same question, kind of, you know, there was a while when it was like, what's your favorite Taylor Swift song for various different, you know, but they asked everybody, or not a bunch of people on the Duke football team, if you were playing one-on-one with Caitlin Clark, who would win? And only one person admitted that Caitlin Clark would win. And he was like 21-20.
Yeah.
Everyone else was like 21-0, 21-10. She can't score on me. She can't get past me in the paint. And I was like, she doesn't have to. She can take it from the logo.
Yeah. Maybe we'll pump the brakes on Duke's football team being better. But basketball team, sure. That's about it. This is a train wreck of rankings. And not just because NYU fell below Columbia for the first time in a while, which is weird.
Not the weird part.
We're going to say that that's a pretty weird part. Okay. But clear down, tied for 9th, NYU with Northwestern and Michigan. So a lot of this does stem back to the ill-advised decision that Yale made and that everyone followed of not providing information to U.S. News. The information they were providing, a lot of it was, you know, like the U.S. News' rankings, we never really loved in a lot of ways. We had a lot of criticisms of them.
Sure.
But they did fulfill a pretty useful niche of giving generally trustworthy senses of of categories that schools are in.
Yes, I think that that's true. And I think it did a pretty good job of sorting law schools by how they're perceived within the industry.
Right.
Which is very valuable, because the truth is law students or prospective law students, they don't have that information necessarily. Most of them don't necessarily have family in it, or, you know, are just unaware of sort of the nuances of the industry. So having a ranking that says this is how the industry that you want to be a part of thinks of the places that you're thinking about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars at is incredibly valuable.
Yeah. And if your position as a prospective student is, well, I've decided to go to Duke because it is so many places better than going to Columbia.
That's a bad decision.
Yeah, then you made a bad decision.
Yeah.
It's just a real arbitrary mess. It's driven a lot by the ill-advised decision not to give that data. And I, when that decision came out, it was, we never were huge fans of the U.S. News rankings in a lot of ways, but they did have these benefits. The argument for not giving this data was complete gibberish. It was this idea that, oh, well, we're going to, it's important for, you know, helping out students to not give this information. Part of the argument was that some of the financial information that they gave, they argued was unfairly benefiting rich students over poor students. Didn't mm-hmm. make any sense, because it was basically trying to say that getting into questions of how much debt the school leaves you in are bad because rich students don't have debt. So it gets a weird, but put aside the small number of super rich people in the world, the debt load is arguably the most important financial part of this decision, whether or not the industry cares about that, and which frankly is why we have a different ranking. The above the law rankings right. have always existed, and they always have schools like Penn and Duke much higher than some of these power schools. But there's a reason, because we specifically say our rankings aren't about which school is better in some sort of an objective way, but it's about trying to evaluate how much debt you're going to be in vis-a-vis what jobs you're going to be able to get on the back end.
Right.
And these are good deals for that. And you can take it for that,
for that purpose.
I don't think if you get told I can go to Yale and they're going to pay for it, you would not look at the above the law rankings and say, well, no, I think I'll go to Penn instead. Like, you
right.
wouldn't do that.
Right.
We wouldn't encourage that. And that's okay. The U.S. news rankings, though, purport to be the sort of thing where you would just look at the, whether you should or not, you would just look and say, well, this one's higher ranked, so I should go there. And this is gibberish.
Yeah. I think that's true. I can remember, you know, a bunch of years ago now, when someone asked, you know, I'm deciding between these kind of elite schools, and, you know, if the money is about the same, what should I do? And I said, you should look at the U.S. news ranking.
Yeah.
And I think that you're right that there used to be a really clear sort of lines in the rankings, right? There was the very, very top Yale, Stanford, Harvard, that very, very top tier. Then there was the Columbia, Chicago, NYU line, which, you know, maybe they changed positions within those places, but those were sort of the next tier before you kind of hit the rest of the top 14 law schools. And then you kind of had the top 25 line, and then you had sort of more of the tiers after that. And that was very, very true for a lot of years.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a generational thing as well, because somebody could have graduated from law schools 15 years before you, but those general lines were so well entrenched that maybe some law schools went up or some went down, but it was small enough differences and meaningful enough. It was a giant deal when somebody, you know, got into the top 14, because the top 14 had been
well,
the top 14.
They didn't do it for
right.
years
it
and
had
years
literally
and years.
Been yeah. since the creation of the. But now they are such gibberish that who even yeah. There's no longer a T14. Yes, they have ceded that bit of branding U.S. News has in order to try to recapture what they once had.
Yeah, I mean, I guess technically there's only one newcomer to the T14 here,
sure.
But
my point is that was the story for years.
Mm-hmm.
And now this whole thing is such a mess. You have NYU at 9. Like, what? What? Okay. LOL. You have Duke at 4. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
So I want to go back a little bit to, I've now refreshed myself on some of the incredibly terrible arguments that were made for not giving data to mm-hmm. to U.S. News. One of the arguments was they wanted to get rid of some of the employment data because their concern was, well, U.S. News counts as unemployed if somebody is working in a school-funded job or something like that. And I was like, yeah, because they're unemployed. That's why they do that. And the reason is this dates back to the old days, predating our time at Above the Law. This was a huge problem, was that schools were attempting to game the system by throwing money at unemployable graduates so that they would meet the 10 months, 9 months after graduation, are they employed, tick that off, and then they cut them astray and they have nowhere to go and can't work, but they appear to be working at that right. juncture and boost the rankings. So that's why U.S. News stopped caring about it. Now we got Yale out here going like, well, we don't want to participate in that. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, right, that it really wasn't a problem for the top law schools, right? Because if you're doing some school-funded job, you're probably doing some public interest work, and you probably mm-hmm. have a different career path, and that's okay. And you're probably fine, right? If you graduated from Yale and you have a school-funded right. job for 10 months or a year or whatever it is, you're probably fine. The problem was not at that tier. The problem was at the lower tiers. And these were schools that were pretending like they're employment rate after graduation was palatable numbers in like the 60s because they had tranches of students right. in funded jobs by the law school. And that is unfair to prospective
so
law
students.
So you've
got these elite schools who've now ruined these rankings by playing games with it so that they could take a moral stance about people working for the school. Mm-hmm. And all they've done is legitimized all of the diploma mill action that's right. happening below. It just really egregious. People should be more mad about these schools and their ridiculous, I'm not going to cooperate with U.S. News stance. Anyway.
Yeah.
We've ranted for a bit.
We have.
All right. Anyway, those rankings are out. The above law ones will be out in due course. McDermott Will & Emery is Vault's number one law firm for associate satisfaction 3 years running. Why? Because they're doing big law better. McDermott is about achieving excellence together. Their culture is collaborative and inclusive. McDermott is a place where you can build your dream legal career. Their focus on mentorship, training, and wellness supports you throughout your journey. In 2023, 73% of our associates earned at or above Cravath's bonus scale, and 65% of those associates earned above the Cravath scale in 2023, all with a lower hour threshold. Want to see how your life could be better at McDermott? Head to careers.mwe.com/above the law. Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Callidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Callidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Callidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CallidusAI.com. That's CallidusAI.com. So we're back. Law firm sleepy time.
Yeah. Holidays that I didn't know were a thing, but there's apparently a World Sleep Day.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, Simpson Thatcher decided to celebrate it by giving their associates a package of sleep-themed gifts.
Okay.
Essential oils, sleep masks, pamphlets and books about how to get good sleep and why sleep is so important. Unfortunately, it did not go over super well with the rank and file at the firm because it is, in fact, their jobs at Simpson Thatcher that is causing them to have terrible sleep.
Right. So did they give a new billing code for sleep time? Because if that's not what they're doing.
Yeah, then all this rings pretty hollow. Yeah, I think this story was first broke by our friends across the ponds roll on Friday. One of the quotes from an associate there is like, yeah, but it's the corporate team that makes me stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning doing this. So what am I supposed to do then? And it made me think, I remember when I was an associate there, it was ill, you get sick occasionally. And I went home maybe like 10 or 11 o'clock at night and I fell asleep and had my phone, my BlackBerry was next to me. That's how old it was. It was a BlackBerry, not an iPhone. I had it next to me and I just didn't hear it buzz, and I got in trouble at 6 o'clock the next morning because they couldn't find me at 2 a.m. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I was asleep.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly entered the office on Thursday and left on Saturday as a fairly routine matter sometimes.
I used to have a blanket and pillow in my office so that I could go to sleep underneath my desk.
Yeah. a full-on Costanza there. Yeah, no.
It was a great idea.
Yeah.
Especially if you had one of those like L-shaped desks. It was that corner was deeper than you think it's going to be.
See, and that's why, look, I'm a fan of revolutionizing the office as a place, because we now live in a world where hybrid work is doable and probably preferable. That said, the everyone gets their own office with a closing door was very critical for that sleep issue. I remember I was on a trial team at one point, and the senior associate told me to just go to sleep and, you know, in the office so that we could, you know, they could get me later. And I was like, I can't really, because there's also a deal happening and I have an office mate right now. So I can't sleep in my office.
Yeah, and maybe it's also true that, you know, as hybrid becomes more accepted, that expectation that you're there is less. But I think it also supercharges the whole, I missed the call because I was sleeping. And, you know, for me, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, but maybe it's you've been working for a lot of hours and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon because you've been working for 15 hours and you fall asleep when you fall asleep. But if you're not in the office and sort of able to deal with the blowback immediately, like, oh no, I'm here, you just couldn't find me, I'm here. I think that they not being able to immediately get a hold of somebody at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whenever you happen to be able to catch your 5 minutes of sleep seems worse when you're not physically in the office.
Right. Well, anyway, so nice try, Simpson Thatcher, but
you know, swing and a miss. Yeah. Not all of them are going to be winners.
Yeah.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
All right. So we talked last week. We had Liz Dye on. We talked about a lot of various Trumpy related things. Among them, Trump had managed to get a bond from a place out west, a billionaire who is apparently made their money in subprime car loans, agreed to put up the 170 or whatever million that it had been reduced to. That was immediately returned by the court for having a series of clerical errors. That has now metastasized into even more. I think when we last spoke about it, there were some concerns about this. They have gotten way worse. It seems as though the financial documents for this company, it doesn't even have enough assets to cover this.
Well, it's not great.
There's a requirement in New York, anyway, if you're posting one of these sorts of appeal bonds, that you agree as the surety company that you are going to be liable for this. And basically, it's a shifting of responsibility. If the person loses their appeal, you know, you're on the hook. You have to go after that person. You got to send Dog the Bounty Hunter or whatever out to that person and get the money from them. And that exists for a lot of good reasons, to protect the money available to execute the judgment on behalf of the victims. And it takes the state out of the job of having to go chase people down. You've agreed to cover somebody, so you agree that you're the one who has to get the money back from them, if you're ever going to get the money back from them. This agreement apparently has as a condition that if Trump loses his appeal, Trump's on the hook for it, which is the opposite of what New York requires. That seems like a problem. It seems from the finances that the company doesn't have enough reserves to cover any of this sort of stuff. In response to that, Liz wrote an article about this. In response to that, the representatives of this company said, well, we're not a New York company, so we're not bound by those, except they're underwriting a New York, but that was the first problem, was that they weren't registered. That was the first thing the court sent back. It seems like a real mess. And then the folks at ProPublica, it was ProPublica, right? I can't remember.
Probably.
Yeah, who've been took a break from finding every time Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas do something wrong. They found that it seems as though this company was willing to and in negotiations with Trump about producing a bond like this to cover the full amount, the full $500 million.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
since it doesn't appear as though they have enough money to do the reduced amount, is weird. But also it raises the issue that the only reason it got reduced was that Trump's folks, legal team, went into the court and said they couldn't find anybody willing to even entertain giving the $500 million,
right,
which whether or not these people actually were have a serious ability to cover that, they were
willing to
try. And
right.
So
you have at least an obligation to amend your filing when that becomes true.
So that does seem as though the Trump legal team just ignored that when they made the request based on the idea that nobody was willing to do it, which certainly seems like you're not being candid. It is also true that the Trump legal team may not have been involved in all the right hand, left hand, what the left hand's doing kind of conversations, but it certainly raises some concerns if you're in the Trump orbit and worried about sanctions or anything like that.
Yes. Yes. I imagine that would be a concern if I was doing that.
Like this hearing on the issue is going to get
ugly, I think, fast.
Yeah. I did see, though, that the New York Post has taken the bold stance. The New York Post editorial board, though, took the opposite.
Where I always go for.
It's weird because everybody else is, this is incomprehensible. This makes no sense. This is gibberish. Like, these are real concerns with this bond. And they took the stance that it's more nitpicking about irrelevant nonsense that we're questioning it. And their reason being that, I mean, of course they're going to have the money, right? So why should we worry about this?
Yeah. I mean, that seems wildly
naive.
I
was thinking about it, and I wonder if to some extent it fits their theory of the case as a whole, right? Because the theory of the case as a whole, from Trump's perspective, is it doesn't matter that they tried to defraud lenders by giving false valuations, because at the end of the day, Trump paid these loans off, and so therefore there was no victim.
Right.
Now, put aside that the banks could very easily have gotten more money by charging higher rates if they thought there was a increased risk, so that would be a victim. But also, the lack of a victim in certain civil cases matters. You know, there has to be a harm. When you're talking about some of these regulations, the reason these regulations exist is because there are certain behaviors that are bad regardless of whether or not they cause harm. Whenever I hear somebody make this argument, I respond with the example of, that would be like saying that a Ponzi scheme is totally cool so long as you stay ahead of it. Ponzi scheme being like what Madoff did, where you're taking in money and pretending there's more money and you're just stealing it from new clients to pay out old ones. If you stay ahead of it and you keep bringing in more new clients than you have old clients cashing out, you can keep that in the air forever and it would technically have no victims because everyone's getting paid off. But it would still be wildly illegal. And that's really the better corollary to what Trump's situation is when they say there were no victims. It's like, no, the fact that he paid all this off doesn't change. He engaged, the court found, engaged in this risky behavior that opened up financial institutions to major harms that we have laws to prevent them from having to be exposed to. Yeah.
Sure.
Anyway, sorry, that was just... Not about the
bond, but certainly, plays into it.
But if you're the New York Post and your whole vision of this case is there are no victims, then your take is, why does anybody care about this bond? It'll eventually get paid. I'm sure of it. Like, that's the whole mentality of all of this.
That remains to be seen what will eventually be done about this suspicious-looking bond situation.
So the hearing on that, I believe, is scheduled for April 22nd. So we've got a little bit more time.
Got a little bit of time wondering, what'll happen. And theoretically, by that time, the jury selection will have already begun in the Trump hush money case, which is currently scheduled for April 15th.
A lot of things going on. All right. Well, I think that's it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. You should subscribe to the show, leave reviews, write things, give stars. It all helps. You should be reading Above the Law, obviously, so you read these and other stories before we chat about them here. You can follow the social medias. It's at ATL Blog. I'm at Joseph Patrice. She's at Catherine One, the numeral one, over at Blue Sky. The only difference is that I'm Joe Patrice over there. You should be checking out other shows. She's the host of The Jabot. I'm a guest on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. There's a panoply of other shows from the Legal Talk Network. Oh, wait. Isn't Panoply like a podcast company or something like that? Is that a thing? Maybe I shouldn't say panoply. A wide variety of. A myriad of.
You've got vocabulary words. You just use them all.
So I don't think that was all of them, but
several of them.
Fair. And so with all that said, we will check back in with you next week.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.